What if the board game sitting in your closet, the one that sparked countless family arguments and taught you to build hotels on Boardwalk, was actually designed to warn you against everything it seems to celebrate? In 1973, when economics professor Ralph Anspach's young son asked why monopolies could be fun in a game but bad in real life, he stumbled onto one of corporate America's best-kept secrets. Monopoly, played by over a billion people and sitting in one-third of American homes, wasn't invented by an unemployed salesman during the Great Depression, as Parker Brothers claimed for decades. Instead, it emerged from the mind of a progressive woman who wanted to expose capitalism's dangers, not glorify them. The real story involves stolen ideas, buried competitors, and a legal battle that would expose how the game itself became the very monopoly it was meant to critique. Elizabeth Maggi defied early 1900s conventions. Working as a stenographer in Washington, D.C.'s Dead Letter Office, she spent free time writing, performing, and inventing. Her abolitionist father, who'd traveled with Lincoln, instilled social justice values. Financial panic forced 13-year-old Lizzie from school into stenography, one of few professional fields open to women, paying far less than men earned for identical work. Lizzie's passion was spreading economist Henry George's radical ideas. His Progress and Poverty outsold everything except the Bible in the 1880s, arguing that while people should own their creations, land should belong to everyone, directly challenging monopolists like John D. Rockefeller, whose Standard Oil controlled 90% of America's refined oil. In 1904, Lizzie patented the Landlord's Game to make George's theories tangible. Her board featured play money, property deeds, and spaces like poorhouse and go to jail. Most ingeniously, she created two rule sets, one where all players benefited from wealth creation, another where winners crushed opponents, demonstrating capitalism's dual nature. The game found devoted followers in Arden, Delaware, a utopian community where land couldn't be bought, only leased. Residents created handmade versions with whimsical spaces like Wayback and Lord Blueblood's estate. Prominent intellectuals, including muckraker Upton Sinclair and economist Scott Nearing, spread the game throughout the Northeast. As the game spread organically through colleges and social networks, Lizzie's name disappeared. Like a folk song, each group added modifications, chance cards, local street names, new tax rules. Daniel Lyman discovered a version in 1927 and created Finance for Commercial Sale. Advised that Monopoly was too widely used to patent, he chose a different name, then sold his interest for just $200. Before moving on, he taught the game to Quaker friends in Atlantic City, who made one fateful change, replacing generic properties with their city's famous streets. Ruth Harvey's card table in Atlantic City became a permanent fixture for game nights in 1929. She painted oilcloth boards, while real estate agent Jesse Rayford organized properties into color groups based on actual Atlantic City values. The game mirrored the city's brutal segregation. The cheapest properties, Baltic and Mediterranean Avenues, sat in the predominantly black neighborhood, while Park Place and Boardwalk represented the luxurious white hotel district. The Atlantic City Quakers debated mechanics endlessly, adding hotels, utilities, and trolley references. In September 1932, newlyweds Ruth and Eugene Rayford brought the game to their Philadelphia neighbors, Charles and Olive Todd. Charles Todd loved it immediately. When he encountered childhood friend Esther Jones, now married to Charles Darrow, he invited the couple to learn. After several game nights, Darrow requested written rules, claiming he wanted to teach others. Todd handed over a board featuring colored triangles and Atlantic City streets, including his accidental misspelling of Marvin Gardens. This simple act of friendship enabled one of gaming history's greatest thefts. Charles Darrow was drowning. Unemployed with no degree, he relied on wife Esther's weaving income to support two young sons. Philadelphia was devastated. 300,000 seeking work, soup kitchen lines stretching blocks, 1,300 repossessed houses sold monthly. When infant Dickie developed scarlet fever, leaving him brain damaged, their troubles compounded. After learning Monopoly from the Todds, Darrow saw salvation. He befriended cartoonist Franklin Alexander to jazz up the design with charming illustrations. Unlike Lizzie's version critiquing capitalism, Darrow's sleek board celebrated it. When Wanamaker's agreed to sell the game, Darrow hired a printer. Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers rejected him in 1934, but he persisted. In early 1935, struggling Parker Brothers reconsidered. Leader Robert Barton struck a deal, $7,000 plus royalties. Monopoly exploded, 278,000 units year one, 1,751,000 year two, saving Parker Brothers from ruin. The Darrows placed Dickie in care, purchased a farm, and Esther raised orchids. When journalists asked how he'd invented it out of thin air, Darrow called it a freak, entirely unexpected and illogical. This deflection concealed a darker truth. He'd photocopied the Todd's game, misspellings and all. Robert Barton demanded proof of ownership. Darrow provided a letter claiming the game was his brainchild, inspired by a college lecture, despite never attending college. When Parker Brothers discovered similar games from 1902, they filed for a patent anyway, approved in 4 months with only Darrow's name. Parker Brothers systematically eliminated competitors, purchasing finance and negotiating with Easy Money. When Texan Rudy Copeland created inflation, they sued for infringement. Copeland countersued, claiming Monopoly was public domain. Parker Brothers settled for at least $10,000, buying Copeland's permanent silence. In November 1935, George Parker met Lizzie Maggie in Arlington, Virginia. He offered $500 for her landlord's game patent and to publish three of her creations, no royalties. Believing her economic ideas would finally reach mass audiences, Lizzie accepted. That's roughly $9,500 today, compared to the millions Darrow would earn. She wrote a poignant farewell to her beloved brainchild, hoping Parker Brothers would honor its high purpose. Her games received little publicity and faded into obscurity. In her final years, she worked as a typist at the U.S. Office of Education, still teaching single tax classes from home. During the 1973 oil crisis, Ralph Ansbach created Anti-Monopoly, a game where players broke up conglomerates. After major companies rejected it, he self-funded 2,000 copies using credit cards and summer school earnings, all sold within 10 days. In February 1974, Parker Brothers sent a cease and desist letter. When they refused compromise, Ansbach fought back. During his deposition, his son Mark discovered in A Toy Is Born that Monopoly wasn't Darrow's creation, but was based on The Landlord's Game, patented in 1904 by Lizzie J. Maggi. Ralph tracked down early players who confirmed the game predated Darrow and had always been called Monopoly, proving the name was generic. Charles Todd produced an old maid box containing a blue oilcloth board with Atlantic City streets, including the Marvin Gardens error Darrow later claimed as his own. Most significantly, Ralph found a 1936 photograph showing elderly Lizzie holding game boards with Monopoly boldly printed. She received only $500 with no royalties. In June 1975, General Mills offered Ralph an executive position plus over $500,000 to settle if he surrendered Anti-Monopoly. Despite financial strain, the Ansbachs rejected it. By November 1976, the trial commenced. Despite testimony from 9 early players and Robert Barton admitting Darrow wasn't the originator, Judge Spencer Williams ruled against Ralph, ordering all Anti-Monopoly games destroyed. On July 5, 1977, Parker Brothers buried approximately 40,000 Anti-Monopoly games in a Minnesota landfill while journalists watched, a dramatic warning to competitors. The case devastated the family. Ruth developed multiple sclerosis symptoms, their sons faced school ridicule, and their finances collapsed. Yet, Ralph persisted. In summer 1982, the Court of Appeals ruled Monopoly generic and invalidated the trademark. When Parker Brothers appealed to the Supreme Court in February 1983, the court refused to hear the case, cementing Ralph's victory after nearly a decade. Nearly a decade after that first threatening letter, Ralph won. Settlements exceeded six figures, covering legal fees and losses, with terms ensuring anti-monopoly could remain on the market. Ironically, anti-monopoly's countercultural message didn't resonate in Reagan-era America, when monopolistic practices were increasingly viewed as smart business. The case reshaped trademark law, prompting lawyers to lobby Congress. Senator Orrin Hatch proposed an amendment outlawing the consumer motivation test that helped Ralph win. After 55 years, Atlantic City finally acknowledged the game's true origins with a plaque, bringing joy to 88-year-old Dorothea Rayford. "I'm just glad I lived long enough to see it." Parker Brothers quietly revised Monopoly's history, acknowledging Darrow merely presented rather than invented the game. Ralph, now in his 80s, still oversees anti-monopoly with his sons, poised to continue the business, preserving his right to freely discuss the game's history, a right not for sale. The greatest irony? A game created to demonstrate monopoly's dangers became itself the subject of monopolistic practices. Lizzie Maggie's intent, showing how unregulated capitalism concentrates wealth, was completely inverted as Monopoly became a celebration of the system she critiqued. Yet through Ralph's determination, part of Lizzie's legacy was restored. The ideas we play with shape how we understand the world. Sometimes the most important game isn't on the board. It's the fight to ensure truth survives.